hell that I was in, I'd do anything to be better.
I thought like a lunatic.
You kind of just have like that little bit of hope that it will get better.
You're gonna make it.
This began my surrender.
I am a witness of my own growth.
It's a life beyond your wildest dreams, and I just have to say, it works if you work it.
My story, that's what I share.
You're listening to Far From Finished, a weekly podcast where we share new, real-life stories of hope and triumph, told by the people who live them. Today's story comes to us from...
My name is Joseph, and I have been in recovery for 8 years. I have been completely sober for 7 months. My life before addiction is hard to nail down because when you are born into a home where there is addiction, it always has a way of influencing who you are, even before you understand what it is. And so being raised in a household where there was an alcoholic, I didn't understand until I got much older how it affected me and how it affected us as a family. I have a wonderful mother who played shield very well, but eventually I grew up and understood the dynamic and how I deal with emotions or disappointment or habits that I developed looking at my parents and my father in particular. So, but that's like the psychology of it all, the actual nuts and bolts of it. I was born in DC, military family. Every member of my family, immediate family, is military, and I didn't move around a lot, but I did go to 5 different elementary schools just because. And I think that just influenced my ability to make strong connections with people and then like abandon them and be able to compartmentalize emotions, which as an addict is something that you tend to do because you burn bridges quickly. And so being able to have that quality, it's helpful for the addiction, not necessarily for the person. And I did theater in high school, and I didn't do a substance, unlike most people who end up in this space. I didn't touch anything until I was 19. I grew up as the goody two-shoes of the family. My brother was more of the rebel, and I was SCA, SAC, drama, football, and the president of the Youth Alcohol Drug Abuse Prevention Project, which is like a DARE program, but I think unique only to Virginia, where I was raised. So I went into college with this idea that all people who did drugs and alcohol were bad people. I'd seen my father released from jail after his second DUI, and he was a hero to me, and to see that destroyed in that space, and plus just being an angsty teen, plus being in drama, which just lends yourself to being a tad bit more dramatic in general. All of those things added up to me having a very negative view of people who use drugs or alcohol or anything of that sort. And so when I got to college, I was super surprised to see like professors drinking and smoking weed and the stars of the shows, you know, doing cocaine and like, but still like accomplishing things with their lives. And so I was really torn by that. So that was the little crack in the door that allowed me into a space where I started using alcohol, casually, if you will. And so I think for a long time, it wasn't that big of an issue, which is to say that I didn't use it any more or less than my peers. The question of it being an issue is something now in my complete sobriety, I wonder how much time I wasted dealing with my issues through drinking and only drinking to extremes and drinking so much, thinking the only way I could have fun or celebrate something was to drink to do that. So I got through college without trying any hard drugs. I smoked weed a couple of times, but I was still in a space where compared to the people and the ideas that I had been fed in high school, what I was doing was just what young people do. And it was hard for me to understand the path that I was starting to go down, because I didn't look like any of the pictures of alcoholics or drug users that I had seen. And so that, how do you put it, that ego, hubris, allowed me to try harder drugs. And so I tried cocaine when I was still living in Richmond. I'm in Richmond at this point, where I went to college. And it was just like, oh, this is a thing. And I've always wanted to try it. And my best friend is doing it. And we're at this party, so let's go in. And I actually did cocaine once and then do it again for another 8 months when I ended up moving to upstate New York. And the first guy I met when I moved to that town was a drug dealer. But, you know, he was a nice guy. I didn't know anybody. We started hanging out. We go to his house the first time. He opens up his cabinet, and there is a giant bowl of cocaine. And that I would mark as the beginning of the downward spiral. Again, you know, I am a pretty strong-willed person, and so it didn't happen quickly. It was in the process of 3 years, though. By the end of that 3 years, I was definitely out of control. That kind of person who is jumping from house to house to house because I can't pay rent. I almost got fired from the one job I still had because I was taking money from the register. And I had tried to get a job working with young people and failed the urine sample test, which was, I think, the moment where I realized that I was completely out of control. You know, in these spaces, because you think you are hiding it, you think that no one is noticing. And if no one's noticing and saying something to you, then it can't be that bad. But that was definitely a wake-up call for me. I had moved to upstate New York because I was a spoken word artist, and there was a competition called the National Poetry Slam, and this town had a team in it, and they wanted me to be on that team. And so I moved up, and it was going to be for 1 year, one summer actually. And that, because of drug use and alcohol abuse, became 3 years, by which at the end, I had burnt pretty much every bridge I had ever created in that space. And even outside of that space, everything went well for a while. You know, we were artists, we were young, we were writers, were supposed to drink, were supposed to live extreme. But one of the first people I met there was a drug dealer. And he was in our circle of friends. And as it goes with most drug dealers, you know, he was very friendly at first. Prices were cheap. If you were over his house, he'd break you off a little piece just to hang out, just because you were hanging out. And it ended up getting me hooked. And then once you're hooked, you're the perfect customer. And so I started spending all my money. And I was, as I was doing more drugs and more drinking, I was doing less and less art, which I was telling myself was my purpose. But after a while, that was questionable. And that's a kind way of putting it. So I'd say about at the 2 year mark, when use and addiction was at its height, I wasn't writing, I wasn't performing, I wasn't touring. Someone came up to me, and someone from one of the local arts departments came up and asked me if I wanted to put together a show to perform as part of their theater festival. And so I said, yeah, why not? You know, what a wonderful opportunity to try to put together something I'd never done before. And so I just remember putting this one-man show together, which was a compilation of poems and artists dancing to music that had been produced for the poems, and three paintings that were created inspired by the poetry and revealed as I was reading the poetry, and thinking that this was going to be the thing that I would be able to turn my life around on. I stopped using for maybe the 3 weeks going up to the show, because I was super dedicated and I was going to focus, and I was going to celebrate, you know, with an eight ball after the show was done. And I ended up getting high the day before the show and kept using cocaine so I could stay, so I could be awake and stay awake all the way to the show, because I, you know, I used all the way through the night. And so it was like 10 o'clock in the morning. It was like, try to come down and go to sleep or keep using. So I kept using, and I was high during the entire show. And I only mention this because for people who don't quite understand the power of addiction, whatever it is you think you love the most, when you become addicted to a substance, you will put it before that thing, whether it's your family or your child or your art, whatever that might be, it will lose. It's inevitable. It's just human nature. When you take the strong power and pull of our emotions and the strong power and pull of an addiction, and once our brain chemistry flips to the wrong side, it's, you know, it's a hard reality to swallow. And that happened, and it maybe 3 months before the urine test that let me know that I had hit absolute bottom. And, you know, I'm blessed that my bottom wasn't like some people's. You know, it didn't end up in jail. I didn't end up in a hospital. I just ended up the worst version of myself that I could imagine. And that was somebody who wanted to do good, but the way they were treating themselves and allowing themselves to get wrapped up in this awful space was keeping me from being able to do work that I thought was important. And the look in the eyes of the woman who had gotten me the interview, when I went back up 3 weeks later, asking why I hadn't heard back from them, and them reading off the litany of things that they found in my bloodstream or in my urine, and having to face her in that space, I've just never felt so small, because up until that point, at least in my head, I had done a relatively decent job separating myself and my work and my life from the addiction. Even with the show, you know, I still did the show. No, and to my knowledge, no one knew that I was high when I did the show. But yeah. And so at that point, I didn't know where I was going to live. And I ended up going back home to my father, the man who I'd ran away from almost 10 years earlier. And, you know, he was in recovery. He was in AA, and he made space for me. You know, I can imagine what it must feel like to see your child return to you in the state that I was in. And having to witness that kind of heartbreak in the eyes of people you love, it's a hard moment. But if you are open to it, if you are ready to take your life in another direction, it's that kind of look that reminds you what's at stake. You know, they say when you're raising kids, and I can attest to this because I have a 4-year-old, they are more concerned about disappointing you than they are about angering you. And so going home to my parents, I was, you know, they weren't angry. They were just really disappointed. And I think that hurt more than anything, because my parents, you know, once my head cleared and I looked back at what they had gone through to be able to provide a life for us, myself and my brother, you know, my behaviors at first was kind of a spit in the face of all of that. I'm not going to say that I'm not going to say that about my addiction. My addiction is a disease and it needs to be treated as thus. And so I try to separate my behavior there and my behavior before, but nonetheless, you know, it's a hard walk. But yeah, I came back home. I worked with my father. I stopped using. We wrote down my story. We shared it. And I think because I'm a poet and a performer of poetry and someone who tries to get my art in front of the world, I was setting up my own little meetings before I even understood what they were as a space to be able to share openly. And a lot of art spaces are very much without judgment because, you know, people bring their stories to that space and it's a sacred space to us. But it wasn't until after my friend committed suicide that I started sharing with the world again. My friend had committed suicide by overdose. And so it was particularly dramatic. Excuse me, it was particularly, not dramatic. It's particularly ironic to go to this town, go to this funeral, see people sobbing, and then turn around and, you know, have somebody ask me if I wanted to, you know, go to the bathroom and do a line. And I think that was when I realized that I couldn't be part of this life anymore because I had been out and I'd seen out and I was trying to get my life together. And so I didn't partake in that space. And I came back to DC and I wrote a poem for my friend, for myself. I don't know if I wrote it for my friend. You don't do things for the dead, you do things for the living. So I guess inspired by my friend death and I guess inspired by his life, inspired by his potential and inspired by the potential that was lost, I wrote a poem that changed my life forever. The poem is about talking to people when they need to hear it most, in spite of the fact that you yourself might not be in the best position in your life. There is no perfect time where you are perfect and above repute to say things to people. If you see something, you have to say it. If courage is a principle that you say you live by, if love is something that's important to you, if family is something that you say you're willing to die for, at the very least, you should be able to speak for it. And so I do this poem now, and I've said it thousands of times. And, you know, it's on the internet. We filmed the video for it. And, you know, that equals to millions and millions of words all in penance for the 30 words I wish I would have said when my friend was still alive. And now it's kind of the weight has been lifted, you know, through forgiveness, through therapy, through just hearing the stories of so many people and being accepted into so many communities. I've been able to let that weight go. And I feel like now I do that poem out of love for myself, love for all the people in the audience who need to find love for themselves and forgive themselves and move on, or find the courage to say the thing to the person that's still in their life. I do it for good now as opposed to as a punishment. And it's allowed me to reconnect to the poem in a way that I think now brings more joy out of folks, which is weird because of the poem about, you know, facing yourself after your friend committed suicide, but there's light at the end of it. There's a lesson that those of us who are still here can be strong and powerful and influencing to the decisions that we make. I am a firm believer that recovery means many things to many people. There are very few things in this life, especially as someone who works in education, there's very few things in this life, in this world, that I think are one size fits all. You know, if one soul is different than the other soul, and one personality is different than the other personalities, and one person's intersections is different than another person's intersections, it is, I think, foolish to feel like there is one way to treat every one who has a particular ailment or disease. And so that being said, I do feel in retrospect that there could have been a more effective way for me to have entered recovery, but I piecemealed it together and through trial and error. I moved back to DC. My father was still in AA and was actually a sponsor at the time. And I would just sit and ask him questions. And he would have me go through some of the exercises that people go through in AA, as far as recording your story, creating, you know, list of people to whom you need to make amends, and really pursuing that process. That plus me overworking myself. I was working 70 hours a week. This is the part that I do not recommend. Just so that I could keep my hands busy, and so that I was exhausted by the end of the day, so I wouldn't go out and like try to find something to do. I mean, idle hands, devil's workshop, the whole thing. But when I stopped doing coke, I all of a sudden wasn't able to drink the same way that I had been for those past 3 years, which if anybody who's ever done coke and drink, you know that one goes up and the other one brings you down, and you think you like are existing in this beautiful middle place. But the more coke you do, the more you have to drink to find that even till. And so when I stopped doing coke, I started drinking again, and I realized that I didn't have the same tolerance. And so I thought, all right, well, if you just keep it simple and you don't abuse it, you can keep doing this. And so in that recovery and sobriety are not always synonymous. My recovery started when I stopped taking or using cocaine, rather. My sobriety, which is something that I had been in and out of for, you know, months at a time, but didn't stick until I started going to AA. And I know I just jumped 8 years, but I just wanted to, I don't know, make that understood, because if somebody, as I will elaborate on, that goes out into the world and tells his story and motivates people, it has always been something that I found weird to talk about, because there are so many people to whom recovery equals sobriety. And I think that is what it means to me now. But, you know, I'm not going to look back at my journey and take anything away from the struggle and the different awakenings that I went through in that process. Comedian, I think it's Louis C.K. I don't know if he's quoting someone else, but I remember him saying that if you go back and you take away all of your mistakes, you erase yourself. And that's not to say that I wish I could go back and take away any of the hurt that I caused, but yeah, it's my journey. So to that journey, it all started with the poem that I wrote, Talk Ugly, which you've heard about, you know, 6 times now. I wrote that poem and I went to the National Poetry Slam and I did that poem and it went well. And then I started doing that poem around town, DC, and I started featuring at different open mics, and people really were responding to that poem. And, you know, I started writing new poetry and I was back in the scene, and I never thought of myself as someone who was going to become an advocate for recovery. Again, I didn't think it was a space that I fully belonged in with people who were completely sober, which is how most people see it. And say 4 years after writing that poem, I was invited to an event that was sponsored by SAMHSA and NIDA at the Swedish embassy called Shattering the Myths. And I was just invited as a performer, one of the performers, to share my poem. And I went and I did the poem. And, you know, in that room with those folks, people came up to me and was like, tell your story. We need you to tell your story. We want you to go around and will you talk to kids here and go to this space. And all of a sudden, I found myself moving around, just going places and doing that poem and telling people the story of my friend and how I stopped using cocaine. And again, just thought I was doing like small stuff. Never thought it was going to erupt to the space that it did. But the organization that ran that event on behalf of NIDA and SAMHSA eventually hired me to come work with them and to create programs for young people to be able to destigmatize and create safe space and give clear and accurate knowledge about drug and alcohol abuse and substance use disorder and mental health and mental illness. And so again, now I'm in this space and I'm using my story as the catalyst or the catalyst for the basis of the program, which was take your story, write about it, share. And from there, we will be able to create community where there was none and bring to light these issues that we are all somehow being touched by. And then that grew. It did well. And now, at that point, 2 years into doing that and creating that that show and revamping that show and doing, you know, nationwide prevention marketing campaigns, it became clear to me that this was something that was going to be in my life. And what happened was I started sitting down with people who had gone through treatment programs, and I started sitting down with people who had gone through AA and other rooms. And I started realizing that I needed to reassess my relationship with alcohol. And I was not a binge drinker. I was not someone who couldn't just have one drink and walk away, but I was someone who used alcohol to deal with anxiety and depression and anger and pretty much any emotion on the spectrum that wasn't positive. And I needed to reevaluate that. And I went to a doctor and realized that I, you know, my entire life, I've had an anxiety disorder, and that I was drinking to fix that. You know, they say often that drinking isn't the problem, it's the solution. The problem is, you know, whatever it is that's going on in your life or in your mind or in your space that you are having problems dealing with in a healthy manner, that you've never been given the tools to deal with in a healthy space, and in a healthy way. And so I decided that my life needed that type of stability. And so 7 months ago, the day before Thanksgiving, I went to my first meeting, and it changed my life again, as when I stopped using cocaine, changed my life, because it got me to the space where I finally was addressing the part of myself that was really hurting and the part of myself that had this mental illness my entire life and never known it. And that got me to the really healthy and clear space that I'm in now. And while all of that is happening, you know, I'm being invited to speak with the Surgeon General at the Facing Addiction event. I'm being invited to speak at the American Society for Addiction Medicine Conference. I have 3 or 4 more presentations lined up, and that's not my day job. Like, my day job is I run after-school creative writing programs for high school kids and create curriculum for teachers and do professional development, teaching folks how to put contemporary poetry into classrooms. But I find myself being pulled to this work because it allows me to use my life story and my life's work at this point, creating and facilitating the generating of words by, you know, people of all ages in a completely new and different way, and to actually be able to see like tangible differences in people's lives that I've been able to work with, and to go into a room of 3,000 people who work in this industry and be able to inspire them, to go into organizations that have very dedicated workers who are being pulled down by the rigmarole of the everyday grind and struggle, and help them reattach themselves to their initial motivation and inspiration to be in this work, and to see them revitalized. That is a beautiful and amazing thing. And I'm honored to be able to be a part of doing that, going out, giving keynote speeches and helping folks create programs in their treatment centers and in their local high schools that will empower people, you know. And as I've said at the beginning, like, I believe in empowering people through love. I think prevention is something that needs to be done through love and care. I think that recovery is something that needs to be done through love and care, and fear doesn't do anything for anybody. I don't believe in doing anything out of fear. Danger is real and important, and all of these things are dangerous, and it's important to note that and to be relevant, to be aware of that. But the reason why we want young people not to start using drugs, the reason why we want people who are in the grips of addiction to seek recovery is so that they can have beautiful, meaningful, purposeful lives and find love and put more love into the world, because the more positive energy there is in our world, I think the better it is. That's how you make the world better, not necessarily, you know, through building things or giving money out. But if we can push forward this idea of taking care of ourselves, and the revolution starting within each individual, and allowing that to compound to your home life, and then from your home life to your school life, and your school life to your community, city, state, nation, world, then I think, you know, we have a chance to do something about this epidemic. And I'm not just talking about the current like opioid epidemic. That is something that's super important and super important and definitely destroying hundreds of thousands of lives. But there are and have been issues with drug addiction and alcohol addiction in places that have not seen any relief or any, you know, nationwide program set into place to make sure that those people can find a better life. And, you know, living here in DC and working with young people in DC and seeing families and communities that are mostly people of color, it is, I'm hopeful that, you know, the nation's attention is turning towards this issue. And I work for a wonderful organization called Split This Rock out of DC, Poetry and Social Justice, and I run the youth programs there. And in that, I have many different hats that I wear, but that's something that I really love to do and am blessed and honored to be doing it, because it is, in fact, as I said the other day on social media, my day job is my dream job. However, this is the other thing that I've been doing, and it's starting to take off, and I'm starting to actually see myself possibly doing this full time sometime in the future. But I like to call it motivational speaking. I take poetry, I take my story, I take the lessons I learned working with young people, and I go from space to space as I am invited to do so, and try to either inspire young people to either stay sober or seek sobriety if they are in need. I work with adults who work in the industry and try to reconnect them to their initial inspiration and motivation. I work with folks in treatment centers who need new ways to get their story out and to reattach themselves to their own humanity. And I also think I work as an advocate, a bridge between the world of recovery and the rest of the world, doing my best to give language and voice to this population of people that so desperately need the compassion of the mainstream world, because we are all in this together. And, you know, there's no greater reason, there's no greater lesson to be taken from this besides, you know, what affects one of us affects all of us, whether you get to see it or not. And so it is in everybody's interest to try to really make some change in this space. And so I'm very lucky, very honored, very motivated to be a part of that movement. A good way of knowing whether you should go and seek help or seek someone else's opinion who is an expert in this space is very simple. If you have to ask, you should probably go on and find out from somebody. You know, if it's something that's in your head, if you're concerned about it, or if your friends are telling you you're starting to get out of control, even if you can't fully see it yet, humble yourself. Think about all of the life that you have to lead. Think about all of the people that depend on you, that will be hurt by your demise in one way or the other. And just go seek counsel. Therapist, treatment center, wherever it is. You know, I would say the majority of the people in these spaces have lived through this, have people in their families that live through this. This is not work that people accidentally fall into. I think that people out there have your best interests in mind, and that would be my advice in that space. And if you are currently in recovery, if you haven't seen it yet, if something hasn't happened that has convinced you that there is joy and happiness and love left in your life to be experienced, let me be a testament to that. All of the people that I've been able to work with, I've been blessed to work with, they reaffirm that for me. You know, the folks that have 5, 10, 15 years in, and, you know, they're reconnected with their families, or they started new families. They found their life calling, or they've been able to get back to what they were doing beforehand. Like, recovery is just that, you know. It's this thing that we have to constantly work at. But if you do, there's something better. There's a brighter way to live. And just never stop seeking help. And know that that doesn't make you any different than someone who is not in recovery. Because I think all people who are successful in life, whatever you want to define success as, none of them do it by themselves. There is no genuine, I did this on my own success story. Somebody opened the door for you. Somebody gave you advice. Don't be ashamed to do that. Humility is super important in this space. Humble yourself and ask those questions and continue to seek help. Even if, you know, you've been in for 10 years and you feel like you're about to use again, like, go back to the rooms, go back to treatment, do what you have to do to keep your life going in the right direction. It's practice. Practice is an everyday thing, reminding yourself and
positively reinforcing, giving affirmation is something that you have to do every day.